Accession number 18666, real one.
Brian Burt, real one. Where were you born, please?
The actual address you want?
No, the place. The
Southampton.
Which year was this? Which year?
1930.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Southampton?
Some of it was, but others. I was evacuated during the war to North Hampshire, and so some of my schooling, my juniors and senior schooling, was done in the village in North Hampshire, and then at Newbury Senior Council School.
Which village was this?
Walton Hill.
Is that near Newbury?
Yes.
Walton Hill?
Yes.
And it's not in Berkshire?
No, it's in Hampshire. But Newbury's in Berkshire, of course.
Were you evacuated with the whole school?
Yes.
Can you describe what happened when you evacuated?
My brother, who was 2 3/4 years older than myself, we assembled in our school playground in Southampton. We were taken by a tram car down to the Southampton Terminus Railway Station, and there we entrained and eventually ended up at Walton Hill. We were assembled in the school, and then we were given brown paper carrier bags containing 48 hours rations, and then we were taken by the local middle classes, I would think, because they were the people who had motor cars in those days, and we were taken to various guardians. My brother and myself and another lad of about the same age were taken to this house. It was a semi-detached house at the end of a row, and when we arrived, the guardian was cutting the grass, and the person taking us spoke to him, and he was totally unaware of our arrival. He obviously was told that his evacuees had arrived. They weren't expecting us because the beds weren't ready. And this was an old couple of one in their 60s. He was a widower, and she had applied to become his housekeeper, and she'd spent all her life in service and so had no family. And they had married and they were living together in this house. Now, in Southampton, we had lived in a modern council house with electricity, hot and cold running water, indoor bath, an indoor toilet, gas cooker, really all modern cons, all mod cons for those days. We arrived at this semi-detached house, very small. There was no electricity. Lighting was by oil lamp. Cooking was by the black range, old black iron range. Water was collected from a well, which we shared with the house next door. And the toilet was a bucket in the shed outside. And they weren't expecting us. And they weren't very happy because this woman now had to cook and cater for five, where she only used to cook and cater for two. Make three beds where she only had to make one. And the supply of hot water, which was always a problem because there was only the stove. And so they weren't all that happy. Although the gentleman, the guardian, he was quite friendly. But we had the feeling that the woman, we were a burden. Life was quite hard. The winter of 1939-40 was quite a hard winter, and it snowed quite considerably. these this settled on the trees, and it brought a lot of the tree branches down. And in the stillness of the night, you used to hear these branches crashing down to the ground. But that, of course, was a source of fuel. And the next day, the guardian and us lads would go out with saws and axes and ropes and cut these branches up and drag them home for fuel. And these were then used on the stove. Of course, they had to be cut and spliced. We weren't large enough to, or strong enough to wield the axe, but we had to get on the other end of the cross saw that the guardian used to use to cut the logs up. Another problem was, of course, the toilet, which had to be emptied periodically. And this was emptied in the garden. The guardian would dig a hole in the garden, and at night time, it always seems to be done at night time, the bucket would be taken down and emptied into the garden. The garden, there would be a piece of wood through the handle, and the garden would be one side, and us two vacuees on a piece of wood the other side. And the expression was, for God's sake, don't fall over. Water for washing was taken from the water butt outside the back door. And even in the coldest weather, a minimum amount of hot water was put into the bowl for washing. My brother, who was older than me, went to school at Newby by bus, whereas I went to the local village school. And I can well remember going through 3, 4, 5 inches of snow up to the village school. And when you got in the classroom, there was one tortoiseshell stove for warmth. And if the caretaker had got it going, it was reasonably warm. But quite often it was well into the morning before things got going pretty well. And if you sat near that tortoiseshell stove, you almost cooked. Whereas if you sat the other side of the classroom, you really wanted your outdoor coat on. And that's how our classes we survived. Quite often the toilets, of course, were frozen up, but everything was got rained, you know, eventually. And then, after going to the village school for a couple of years, I started going to Newbury. There were three buses that used to come out from Newbury to go around the different villages. And we used to be bused into Newbury for our senior tuition. So from the ages 11 to 12, 12 to 13, 13 to 14, last 3 years of our schooling, we went into Newbury Senior Boys Council School. And looking back, we had quite a good education. We taught to appreciate literature, poetry and things. But unfortunately, one day in February 1943, the 10th of February 1943, we had a lad in our class who got into trouble with the teacher, and the teacher said to him, "What's your name?" Because this teacher had only been with us for a day. And he said to, "What's your name, lad?" He said, "Purdy, sir." He said, "Well, Purdy, you stay in tonight." And I thought to myself, that's about the third time in the last couple of weeks Purdy's been kept in from school. And we left school and went to got the bus home. And we just got home. We only lived a couple of miles or so outside of Newbury. And there were some explosions. A machine gun fire, and just after 5 o'clock, 5:15, 5:20, my brother came up the garden path, because he worked in Newbury at that time, and he said, "I've just caught the first bus out," and he said, sorry, Nipper, no school for you tomorrow. I said, what's on? He said, a German plane dropped a load of bombs. St. John's Church, your school, the almshouses, flat. He said, and then he went on a machine gun the streets. And I learned afterwards that my school friend Purdy had lost his life, along with two other girls, and a council workman, and the teachers were seriously injured. The irony about this is the school we left in Southampton is still there, still being used as a school, and came through the wall unscathed. The school we went to for safety and security was flattened.
How much did being evacuated affect you mentally and emotionally?
Quite a lot. Quite a lot, because none of these people really wanted us, and this, after being at this first house for something like 7 months, my brother and I were moved. She said she couldn't cope with all three of us, and we went to live on a farm, which was very nice, and I enjoyed being on the farm because there were horses, haymaking, harvesting, lovely. Although the people we lived with weren't local, they were in fact people from London who had come down with their employer, to stay at the big house. And during the summer of 1940, our father came up, he rode up on his bicycle to see us, and he said to my brother and myself, would you like to come home for a holiday? And my brother said, sure. The woman we were living with said, if you go home, I'm not having you back. You'll have to find somewhere else to live. I love living on the farm, and so I didn't want to leave the farm. So my brother came home for a holiday and I stayed. But unfortunately, later on in about October, this woman said to me one day, I'm going up to the dairy to look at the flat. Would you like to come along? So I said, sure. So we went up to the dairy, which is just local, nearby. She said, I'm thinking about moving into this flat. I said, oh, that's nice. She said, but of course, there's no room for you. If I do, you'll have to find somewhere else to live. Which was a bit shattering. Because I love living on the farm. There was a woman in the village who used to deal with evacuee movements, and she came to see me. I said, well, I'd like to stay on the farm if I've got to move, but I'd like to stay on the farm. She said, well, I found somewhere, it's just eight, not far away, in a bungalow. So I said, all right. So I moved to this people in the bungalow. There was an elderly gentleman, well in his 70s, his wife, who was a good deal younger, and a daughter. And I stayed there from October, November, December. And I come Christmas, and I hadn't heard from my mum or dad. And then the woman that I was living with said, oh, your mum will be up to see you after Christmas. And I suspected something was going on, but I didn't know quite what. My brother by this time was now living down near where we were in the first place, only in a different house with some different people. And after Christmas, my mum came up and she got us together and she said, unfortunately, your dad's been killed in a road accident. That's why I didn't write to you before Christmas. Which was a bit of a blow. She saw where I was living. She said, I don't like where you're living. She said, I don't like the state of the place or the people you're living with. I'll try and get you back to the woman you were with in the first place. Because my brother was living quite close by. So on the pretext that she wanted me to live near my brother, she went and asked the woman we were with originally if she would have me back. And she said, yes, she would. So that was the reason I moved back to the house we were in first. And I was quite happy to be there. She was a bit more amiable when there was only two of us. You know. But then there was an elderly grandfather in the family. And a niece was looking after this grandfather. And she said she'd had enough. And it was agreed that the woman I was looking after me would take the grandfather and I would go and live with the niece, which is still in the village, about a mile away. So the adults agreed this. I mean, not anything to do, I could do about it, you see. So they swapped. The grandfather came and lived where I was living, and I went to live where the grandfather was living, with the niece. Her husband was away in the army, but she had a small boy of about four, and she also had her brother living with her. I was there for 6 months. One day she said to me, I'm just going out the road to see if I can get a job. I said, all right. I better coming back down the road on the way. And I said, oh, did you get the job? Yes, she said. I said, oh, well done. She said, but that means I can't look after you now. I said, why? She said, well, I've got my own family to look after, and if I'm doing a job as well, I can't look after you as well. You'll have to move. So I said, oh, what could I say? So then this woman who's in charge of evacuees, she comes and she says, I've fixed you up with somebody over the other side of the village. The woman's got two sons and a daughter of her own. I think you'll be happy there. So, moved again and lived with this other family. And that's where I stayed for the last 2 years of my evacuation. And came to 14 years of age in July 1944, when I would have been 14, leaving school. R.A.B. Butler just brought in his Education Act and extended the school leaving age to 15 if you wanted. So I decided to stay on at school. Our school at Newby by then, after the old school had been bombed, we had several weeks off, no school at all. And then eventually they found us another school or another building. It was an ancient Elizabethan house called Shaw House in Newbury. And we were schooled there. And that's where I was at school. And I stayed on for another six... Well, I intended to stay on at school. But in that October, of course, the D-Day was in June of 1944. By October, November, the government had decided that there was no further risk of air raids in Britain and evacuation would end. And so I came back home. My brother had come back, and although he's working in Newbury for a time, he had come back home earlier and got a job in Southampton. So I came back to Southampton, and Mum said, what are you going to do? Are you going to continue your school, or are you going to get a job? I said, well, it's only another 6 months of finding another school and starting afresh. I said, I'll get a job. What would you like to do? No idea. I think you ought to earn a trade. Fair enough. What sort of trade? Electrician? I said, that sounds fine. Okay. So after the Christmas holiday, 1944-45, January 45, I went down to the Labour Exchange with Mum, told her what we wanted, and he gave us names of two electrical contractors. The one I chose was the one that was on the tram route from home. So at 14 and a half, I started work at an electrical contractor's. They wouldn't start your apprenticeship till you were 16. So for the first 18 months, it was just a general dog's body. I used to have to get up at 14 and a half. I used to get up at 6:30 in the morning to be to work at 7:30. We'd leave work at 5:00 and I'd go home. If I was working local, have me tea and go to night school. But this firm was electrical contracting, and we used to get work in various parts of southern England, really. I know at one time we were working down the other side of Mere in Dorset for several weeks, and we would travel backwards and forwards. You could travel down in the firm's time, but you had to travel back in your own time. So we would be at the office at 7:30 in the morning, and then we would get in the cars or vans and travel down to where you're going. But you would then work there till 5:00, and then travel back in your own time, which you didn't get paid, of course. So quite often it was 6:00, 6:30 before I got on at night time, sometimes later, and I still had to wash, shave, change my clothes and get to night school. So at 16 I signed up for an apprenticeship. The salary, I can tell you, was absolutely disgusting. At 13 shillings a week I started, and when I started at 16 it was about 15 shillings a week, and it crept up next year probably 17 shillings, 30 shillings. In my last year of apprenticeship I was getting £2.12 a week. 8 of that was approximately 8 shillings per week National Health Insurance. So at 20 years of age I was taking home about £2.04 a week. An electrician's wage at that time would be between £6 and £7 a week. So I was getting less than a third of an electrician's salary in my last year of my apprenticeship. Directly I get to 21. In fact, before I was 21, I had my call-out papers for National Service. So I had previously opted for the Royal Corps Signals. The reason being, my brother, who was older than me, had done his National Service some years before and had gone into the infantry. And he said to me, whatever you do, Dipper, don't go in the infantry. He said, do too much marching. He said, definitely don't go in the light infantry. They march too fast. A friend of mine at work had gone in the Royal Signals and had told me that 95% of Royal Signals personnel go abroad. And as I had to go into National Service, I wanted to travel. My brother in his service had gone to Germany, Burma and Egypt. He had thrilled me with his stories, fired my enthusiasm, and I wanted to travel. And then Royal Signals, you went to Yorkshire, and I'd never been beyond London. So directly I finished my apprenticeship, within a week or so, I was on my way to Yorkshire.
This is in 1951?
In 1951.
Which month?
July.
What happened then?
Fine. Could you get travel warrants, no problem. Get the train from King's Cross, where I met other people going to Yorkshire, right? Then going to Catterick. We changed trains somewhere, and we end up at Richmond in Yorkshire. Right? There, there's trucks waiting to take us to 7th Training Regiment, Royal Signals, at Catterick Camp. You get out the lorries, you stood there in mass, and there's the drill instructors taking people into their various troops. And I got taken into 19 Troop. I can't remember exactly how, but they drill us in 19 Troop, 7th Training Regiment. And then started 4 weeks, what they call basic training, square bashing. Didn't bother me at all. Having been used to having to take orders at work when I was young, didn't bother me at all. I found the drill instructors fair. There was never any personal thing about it, as far as I can remember. They shoot in bold, but generally, it was never, unless you did something absolutely stupid, it was never a personal thing. And in fact, during our 4 weeks basic training, we all lined up around the drill square, and the RSM drilled the drill instructors. The CO said this had to be done to show them that they could do it, as well as tell us how to do it. So, no problem. The worst thing, one of the worst things of the first 4 weeks, were the inoculations. The first weekend you're there, they give you a TAB on a Saturday morning. And during the day, people start feeling rough. Fever, sickness, your arm aches. I did feel really rough, along with everybody else. We all felt the same. I crawled in the bed that Saturday night like nothing on earth. And suddenly you're feeling better, you go to meals. Monday, it's back to normal. So it says, come on, let's swing them arms. Get that stiffness out of them. That's it. For 4 weeks, you weren't you were hardly laid out of camp. I think one weekend, we were laid out of camp down to Catterick Centre. But basically, from the time you woke up to the time you went to bed, you were doing something. Cleaning your boots, polishing your brasses, drill. Arms, learning about Bren guns, etc. Didn't find it over difficult myself. I just felt if you tried to do what they asked you to do and made every attempt,